Hey, hey, all you slashers and survivor girls. Welcome back to another episode of the Creepin' It Real Horrorcast. I am that good buddy Lunchbox, and god damn, it feels good to say that again. God, I missed you guys. It's been way too long, but I got another episode for you, ready to go, and I'm ready to kick this thing back into high gear, or, you know, just a nice good rev, you know, just wherever you feel comfortable with. So, before we get into the episode, I kind of want to jump in on a little bit of explanation on kind of what went on, but before we do that, always remember that you guys can reach me at any time on the interwebs over on like Instagram at Creepin' It Real, or you can always just email me directly at creepinitreal.cm@gmail.com. Again, I love jibber jabbering or getting movie ideas. Please, like, feel free. It's like I want to make this a big community, and again, it's just nice to just get, you know, connect with other people. So hey, boom, big on yous. So to give a quick little explanation on what was going on. So at the end of our last episode for My Bloody Valentine, you know, Meg mentioned that, you know, she was not able to, you know, continue on with the show just because her schedule is just bananas. And so, like, I mean, I felt bad because, like, I could see where it's like, you know, there is a struggle. It's like every week I have to, like, get on her and just say, hey, did you watch this? And she's like, no, I couldn't, or you know, what have you. So, I mean, it's like, that's not fun. And I know that she did love the show, but it's just work and life and everything else just kind of just, it just takes over and she's got priorities. So, I mean, you know, she needed to do that. And, you know, on top of that, as a little side note, which is really awesome, she just got engaged, which is fantastic. Like, so big, big congratulations to her and Curtis. So, I mean, I'm extremely happy for them. That is a big, big step in their relationship. And I really do hope that they, you know, continue on, and it actually is a really, really strong connection. So, you know, big ups on that. But as far as Creepin' It Real goes, if you do listen to that, the My Bloody Valentine episode, I sounded sad as shit. I did not like that at all, because I didn't want it to end. And so for a while now, I have been kind of going back and forth with whether or not I should continue on doing the show, or, you know, just if it's going to be any interesting with it just being me. Who knows? I don't. We're going to try it. Now, for a while there, in between our little break, I was actually playing a video game called Maneater with my son. And in the game, you play as a bull shark that is swimming around, and all you do is you eat, you know, fish and sharks and, you know, marlin, whales. And then you could also eat other humans and things like that. And it's just like you could actually, like, terrorize, you know, beach resorts and, like, fishing docks and things like that. And it is an absolute gorgeous game. It is so much fun to play. The shark feels really realistic, and the carnage is just, mwah, chef's kiss. But so I got into that, and then I kind of, and I do that thing where I just fell down this rabbit hole. And because I was playing the game, I started, like, jumping on YouTube and watching a whole bunch of shark documentaries. And I got into a lot of, like, the prehistoric stuff, like, you know, like watching, like, all the Megalodon documentaries. And then I got into the great white shark documentaries, like Air Jaws and things like that. And then I actually came across a Mako shark documentary. And because I started watching that, I was getting this feeling. It's like, oh, I want to watch, like, some other, like, shark movies. And it hit me that I haven't watched Deep Blue Sea in a very long time. And that was the movie that I wanted to do for the podcast. This movie is, again, it's near and dear to my heart. Like, I absolutely love Mako sharks. I mean, the great white is my favorite, but, you know, me being a shark fanatic, the Mako is just such a beautiful creature. So this week we got into Deep Blue Sea from 1999. And again, bear with me. Meg is the one that usually does all this stuff, so I'm going to try and do my best here. But we got Thomas Jane as Carter Blake. Saffron Burroughs as Dr. Susan McAllister. We got our boy Samuel L. Jackson as Russell Franklin, the big-time money man. Jacqueline McKenzie as Janice Higgins. Michael Rapport as Tom Scoggins. Stellan Skarsgård, who is absolutely phenomenal, as Jim Whitlock. And LL Cool J as Preacher. And then we also have Ida Turuto. I believe I'm butchering that name, but she plays Brenda in a very small role. Now, this movie ended up coming out on July 28th, 1999. Now, my birthday is July 21st, 1986, and so I remember that I tried to get my parents to take me to go see this movie on my birthday, and they would not. So, I forget what movie I ended up going to see, but because I always try to get them to take me to a movie, like, on my birthday every single year. That was, like, the thing I always wanted to do. But, yeah, so it was July 28th, 1999, and this movie ended up, it was a budget of $60 million, or estimated $60 million, and it ended up grossing in the U.S. about $73.5 million, and then ended up worldwide gross was $165+ million, which again, not too shabby at all. I mean, that's a definite box office there for sure. But yeah, I mean, that one, this movie is very, very interesting for me. Coming from a movie like Jaws, where they were having such problems with the shark and the production that they had to change up the style of the movie, which actually in the long run made it scarier because you never actually saw the creature until probably about 75% away through the movie. Most of the time everything was all under the water. You never got the feel, like, but you still got the carnage. And it was very, very little of the shark. And I think that helped the movie out, greatly. Now, when you come into the modern age of movies where you have a lot of, like, CGI and a lot of the special effects are, like, just in this grander scale. I think it's one of those things where a lot of the movie companies just go, no, we want to see the shark. Like, we got to see the creature. We got to, you know, get everything. It's in your face. It's got to be there, you know, the entire time. Now, like I said, it's like with Jaws, I think it's more, it benefits it more for a movie like that, but for a lot of these modern movies, I kind of agree with it, but I think it's like if it's overdone, that's what really hurts, because then you start to see the flaws and you start to see like the chip in the armor type of thing. The more it goes on, when you have a movie like Jurassic Park. Jurassic Park was one of those movies where you had this stellar, just like realistic practical effects, and like the dinosaurs just looked incredible. They looked so realistic. And then you get the CGI, and the CGI still holds up. They did it right, but they kind of limited, like when you look at like the velociraptors and things like that, that was something that it does hold up. Like, I mean, I've watched Jurassic Park quite a bit lately, and it's every time I watch it, it's like I don't see very many flaws. I mean, it's very, very little as to what you can actually see. Now, when you see a movie like Deep Blue Sea, again, 1999, so I mean, like, shit, in the movie itself, like, a lot of the scientists, the computers are working off of, they're still using fucking floppy disks. So, I mean, it's, like, they're not using MacBooks or anything like that. It's, like, it's still pretty, like, old school technology. So, I mean, I'm going to give them a little bit of a pass on that. But there was a couple of times where they really tried to utilize the shark and make them make them really scary. And there was some stuff that it's like clearly they just could not do with the puppet. And so they had to use CGI. And the thing is that the CGI looks completely different from what the actual puppets do. Sometimes, like, you would see the shark and they would be more of a brownish color because of, like, you know, the sun or whatever. But you could just see where it was more of a sandy color. And then when they get down and under the water or something like that, like, it's more of a midnight blue, or it's like a super dark blue. So it's like it was just the contrast between a lot of the practical and the just the actual CGI just didn't seem to match up. There was one scene where there was a shark attack in, I believe is the bottom of the, it was like in one of the little bottom levels of the, of Aquatica, which is the research facility that they were at. And when the shark came up, it was like this massive monster, but it almost looked purple. It didn't really look, it almost looked like a slug more than an actual shark. So it was a little weird seeing some of that, but at the same time, I was like, you know, just kind of give it a pass because, I mean, there's no way for them to actually be able to film all that stuff with practical. Now, they did actually work on using, it was like CGI puppets, and then I think there was some actual shark footage that was used, which is really good. But I do have to praise them incredibly so for those puppets, because those were some of the most realistic Mako puppets I've ever seen in my life, or just animatronics. I mean, it's just the way that they controlled them and made them move when they were just kind of like just I guess neutral type of thing. Like if there's one scene where they were about to get, it was, I believe it was the Gen 1 Makos. They were dropping them into one of the tanks or one of the, like the holding areas. And they just had it in this little, in a net, right? And they were just going to drop it in, and you could just see it just like kind of thrashing around a little bit and just moving around. And it moved around like a real fish. Like it did not feel like it was a puppet or if it was being controlled by man. Like it felt real. And I was like, then that was really, really cool. And that was the thing, was having them, and also it's like having them move around as like puppets, like in some of the attack scenes were also really cool. But there was some things that, and I'll get into in just a little bit, that were a little bit troubling and kind of on the fuckery side of things. So now to kind of back up a little bit, so we have our main cast here. We start off with our movie opening up with a sailboat out in the water. And it's just it's a group of people out there just having their own little party. And it's just your typical scene. Everyone's, you know, it's like four people drinking, two girls, two guys. They're just having a party, about to, you know, get busy and do their thing, right? And all of a sudden, the shark attacks. And it's a very, very intense scene because the shark, it starts to break through the center of the boat, and it actually smashes through, scaring the shit out of everybody. And this is where we see the shark for the first time. We see the, like, and they really emphasize the teeth of the shark. Well, and then they do the thing, like the music on there, is it just really ramps up, and it kind of, it's not it's not Jaws-like, but you get that kind of that feeling of it's like it's predator music. Like, it's just there's something coming after them. Well, the shark's barreling in on, like, well, so it breaks through the ship, and then it knocks the people off the boat, and then as they're in the water, they're trying to get back onto the boat, and the shark's coming after them, and out of nowhere, it just as some magical, just poof, there I am, you have Carter Blake that just shows up and shoots a spear into the back of, or the tail fin of the shark, and you know, just got, it's got like a zip line on it. And like, so he just, you know, tethers the shark and stops it from coming up. But the thing that kills me is that as you're like, they're filming the, you know, this boat and these people having a party, you don't see any sign of this big ass boat that Carter's on anywhere. Like, he just magically appears when this shark just shows up. Granted, maybe he was tracking it or what have you, but, and he just kind of, they just happened to be there, but it's just, you don't see any sign of the boat, and then he just poof, boom, there he is, and then saves the day. But the scene then moves after the shark attack over into Susan McAllister, who is traveling over to, I guess a board of directors meeting for Russell Franklin, who is the head of the company Chimera. He ends up funding this facility and this research team who is actually trying to tackle the Alzheimer's disease. They are trying to, well, they're basically just trying to wipe it out and cure it. So it turns out where she's in a bunch of shit, because that shark that attacked that boat was one of the test sharks. And one of the test sharks actually ended up getting out. So it made the papers and everything else. And it's a really bad look for the Chimera company. Well, so Russell Franklin has put, I believe they said it was about $200 million into this research project. And he basically is saying that, you know, that with the shark getting out, it's incredibly dangerous and they're going to have to be, you know, more careful in the future. But in doing so, they're going to have to pull the funding from the research group and the whole thing. Well, Susan gets incredibly frustrated because she has a lot in stake with this, because her father has Alzheimer's. And so she ends up kind of putting up to Russell that, you know, she's like, oh, well, my father, it's like every morning he would have to ask, like, you know, where my mother was. And I had to tell him every morning that, you know, that his wife has died. And so every morning she has to live with him coming to terms that his wife, you know, that his loved one is now gone. And so every single day he has to live with that. And she just can't deal with her father being in that much pain. And I know that I've known a few people that have had Alzheimer's. Nothing that's been like incredibly serious, you know, knock on wood. But at the same time, it's like I've known a couple people that have gone through that, or I've had people, and it really does suck. Like, I mean, I don't wish that on anybody. But she ends up saying that, you know, they're trying to wipe this out and they are so close. And so she ends up, I guess, demanding, or she just kind of, she doesn't really, she ends up telling them like, oh, give me 48 hours and I will show you the progress, and I will show you our research, and I will show you like what we're actually going to, you know, what we can accomplish. We will show you results. And then she just walks out. And Russell and or Russell Franklin and the other board, they don't say anything. They just kind of just stare at her, look at her. And a little part of me was kind of like, what if they just said no? Like, it's just no, you're not getting any of that. Like, it's just whatever it is. But he just, lo and behold, he ends up, you know, going along with it to see what their research is. And Russell Franklin ends up hopping on the helicopter with Susan, and he travels over to Aquatica to actually see the facility and kind of get the tour, because he actually has never been to Aquatica. He's never seen what his money is ultimately funding, which is very, very interesting to me, just because it's like, if you're throwing in that much money, it's like, I'm pretty sure you would know, you know, what it's going towards. Now, it's one of those things where, so they get to Aquatica and it's very isolated. So it's, I mean, it's very, very far out from everything, which is nice just because it's like, it allows them to kind of work without having, you know, anything like interruptions or anything like that from you know, passerbys or other like fishing boats and things like that. And for instance, like the shark that did get out, the boat or the sailboat that was out was actually out pretty far. So I mean, it was just kind of like they just happened to be at the wrong place, wrong time type of thing. But so Franklin and Susan end up landing on Aquatica, and Franklin starts to get the whole kind of the tourist tour of the facility. He's going through and he's meeting, and you're kind of getting the whole cast meet up at this point. Like this is the time where you're getting the kind of know, like, who else is going to be in this movie, like who all the players are and things like that. And what was also interesting too is that as Franklin was arriving, the rest of the workers and the crew that work at Aquatica were all leaving for the weekend. And I guess like on the weekend, they only run a skeleton crew. So this whole facility has this massive amount of just people that just kind of just do a number of things on this facility, but then they just hop on a boat, you know, on Friday and just say and bounce. And so Franklin only gets to meet like a few handful of people, but they end up being like some of like the big players that we end up, you know, getting to know. For instance, we end up getting so Franklin ends up getting to meet Janice Higgins. She is a sweet little blonde lady, and she's the one that is taking Franklin all around the facility. And then he ends up running into Carter Blake, and Carter automatically just doesn't trust him. He just sees him as, oh, you're the guy that is going to take down our whole operation. In one flail sloop, you're just going to just, you know, sign something. And it's just like in all of our, you know, my money is going to go away. Because Carter is the shark wrangler. He had a very, I wouldn't say like a sketchy background, but it was, I guess he was a smuggler and he just had some like, bad run-ins with the law and things like that. And so, when I guess this shark wrangler job came about, like, I mean, he was very in, you know, in tune with the water, and he was really good with the sharks. He's really good at his job. So it's like, you know, it was an ideal job for him, just so he could get his money, not have to worry about anybody. It's like, I don't think anybody's ever going to say, like, you know, question him for, for his job, you know, wrangling sharks or whatnot. But at the same time, it's like, he doesn't ask a lot of questions, and nobody asks questions of him either. He just does what he needs to and kind of keeps his head down type of thing. But when he meets Franklin for the first time, he, like I said, they just kind of butt heads, but they just, there's definitely like a rough edge to the meet, and it's one of those, like, he just didn't know how to I guess interact with him and not be a complete dick. But it was funny because, like, Franklin was like, oh, well, that was a really nice interaction. And then Janice was like, oh yeah, like, you actually got full sentences out of him. Normally he would just get like head nods and shrugs, like, that's about it. And then you go through and you end up meeting the rest of the crew. You meet Tom Scoggins. He is, I guess, he's the tech guy there at the facility. He helps run a lot of the equipment that's down there for all of the scientists to work off of. He's also the brainiac of the facility. Like, throughout the movie, they are constantly talking about just the structure of the facility, and he's giving like the end all be all, like, oh, if water fills up in this chamber, it's like you're only gonna have like certain amount of time, or it's like the structure of the walls are just gonna break like toothpicks. And it's just like, so he knows like all the little ins and outs of the structural being of the facility, which is really, really funny. But he's also the wisecracking, like, comedy relief, or he's like the buddy comedy for Carter, because Carter's the very like serious, you know, I'm the heroic, you know, just, I'm just that guy. I just want to live. I need to be the tough dude. Like, and then this guy, he's just it's like the Abbott and Costello. It's the serious guy, and then he's the funny dude. But and it worked too, because in some of his other movies, like one of the other ones that I recently just saw Michael Rapaport in was it was Friday, I believe it was Friday After Next. No, sorry, strike that. It was Next Friday, and he was the mailman that gets chased by Chico the dog. So it was just it was funny to see him in that. But there was a lot of just kind of tension going around when it came to Franklin, because they didn't know how he was going to respond to that. And Franklin, he was actually being very, very genuine, and he was being very, like, he just wanted to know more about what was going on, and he had a genuine interest in what was going on. Like, so there was another scene with him and Carter, and it was just the two of them, and he just asked, like, hey, what does a shark wrangler do? Carter's like, oh, it's about what it sounds like, you know, and that's about it. And then Franklin sees an auger mask, and he just tries to make small talk. He's like, oh man, like, we used to do a bunch of like deep sea wreck diving in one of these, like, you ever done those? And Carter just kind of gives him a shruggy type answer, and again, Franklin just kind of just tries to continue on, and he doesn't seem like he's trying to like bait him into anything. He's just trying to I always feel like it was like, I'm just trying to actually connect with you, dude. I'm trying, like, yeah, I'm funding all this stuff, but it's like I'm genuinely interested in like what is happening here, because this stuff is very new to him. But then it comes out to it where they have that talk of, okay, so you're trying to, you know, shut us down or any of that, and so it became like that conversation. But at the same time, Franklin, he's still kind of like on the fence of whether or not they're actually going to do anything, you know, like shut him down or whatnot. So he's just it's one of those things where, dude, you're trying to like save your job. I'd probably be on my, the best behavior type of thing. So as we get into it, like I said, we met our comic relief with Scoggins, usually you get like the one guy who's the comic relief, right? Well, in this movie, we ended up getting two comic reliefs. The second one being our boy LL Cool J as Preacher, who is the chef of Aquatica. And Preacher was hilarious just because I don't know what it is with LL Cool J and these type of roles, but he always tends to be make it feel very natural for that character. When we watched Halloween and for his role as that security guard, again, it still felt like it didn't feel like it was. I mean, yes, it was LL Cool J, and it's kind of hard to not see him when as that character, or whatever. But at the same time, it's like it felt natural. Like it actually felt like he was a realistic character. Like it didn't feel like it was being put on, or like Busta Rhymes didn't feel as natural in that role during his Halloween role, in comparison to like what LL was. Another really fun thing was that, like, I don't know what it is about LL, but he's like the only like black dude that could actually like survive a horror movie in every single, like in all of the ones that he's in. Like in Halloween, he survived. And in this one, he made it all the way to the end. He got his ass handed to him a bunch of times, but like, I mean, he's still pushed it through. So, good on you, like LL's, agency for that. But Preacher was crazy just because when we first meet him, like he's in there, like in his kitchen, he's baking, and he's got this parrot that he calls Bird. And I don't know what it is about that, but it's just like, I absolutely love when like animals just don't have names. And speaking of animals, to side note, we just got our my guest that just came in. So we have my girl Peach just came in to say hello, and she's just sitting on the couch and taking a nap. Way to go! She's I actually call her my little land shark because it's like I'll go to like take a shower or something, and out of nowhere I'll hear something rustle on my desk. Like she'll jump up like on my desk, grab just random objects and just take them up under my bed and just start chewing on them. It's insane. Like I actually try to put things away. So I call her my land shark because she will just literally just eat everything, and it's hilarious. So I got to try and train her better on that. But yeah, she's such a sweetie. She's such a good girl. Anyways, so Bird. I absolutely love when they give like animals names of just whatever they are. I don't know why it's just so funny to me. But Bird was just a little shit bag. So it was just a little foul mouth parrot. And it was just like, Preacher just decided that he was just going to teach this bird a bunch of just really, really bad phrases. And it's like, I think it was like one of them was like, hey, asshole. Or like one says like, you got a fat ass. And I'm like, that's fucking hilarious. But so Bird was this little foul mouth parrot, and Preacher had a really good connection with him, even though he knew that it's like, okay, I think there wasn't any problems with the bird being sassy with him. But it was nice actually seeing too, because they were all underneath, like Aquatica was underneath the water. And so having a flying animal, and they're kind of, I guess, helped Preacher out with kind of dealing with just being that underwater captivity. Because it felt very much like you were on a spaceship. Like there was nothing else. There's no way that you could get out other than just the water that had these, killing machines in it. But at the same time, it was just, it was nice seeing that the bird could, still function and actually give more comedy to whatever Preacher was doing too. And then there was another scene, too, where they were like, I also love that the bird just did not give two shits. So he ended up, Preacher was walking around. He was hearing a lot of noises, and he was the only one in his area. Everybody else is dealing with the flooding and things like that, and they're trying to work their way up through some of the levels. But Preacher's on his own. He has no idea what's happening. He's just hearing a bunch of like rattling and things like that, seeing a lot of water coming in. And he's walking up this one little staircase, and he's hearing this like roaring sound. And then out of nowhere, the roaring starts to get a little louder, and then all of a sudden the bird just start like screeching, and then it just fucks right off. Like, it just flies right down the corridor. Like, it just says, like, screw you, and then yeet, like, just gone. So, and then leaving Preacher to you know, come face to face with like this massive just tidal wave of water that knocks him down the hallway. And then a little bit later on, as Preacher is walking down these flooded corridors, one of the sharks in the movie ends up getting into the facility and swims down and meets Preacher and tries to attack him. Preacher goes back into his kitchen, and the bird ends up flying back into the kitchen as well, and then lands on top of this pot. Well, Preacher's trying to get the bird back. He's like, hey, you know, like, please, I'm trying to save you. Like, it's like, you know, come on, like, come on. And as he's reaching for it, the shark pops out of the water and then just swallows bird whole. And it's just, it's hilarious. But then, and then he ends up, Preacher uses that as kind of like his big action movie, like, you know, fuck you, you know, kind of like kill sentence. His little tagline, I guess, for the movie is like, you kill my bird. He just like flicks, or like, what ends up happening is Preacher ends up, like, he falls off of the shelf into the water, and then he rushes over to his oven. He has an axe in his hand. It's like a little tiny axe. And he runs into his oven and then shuts the door just as the shark is trying to charge at him. And then he ends up, or the shark accidentally, as it's, well, it doesn't accidentally, but as it's ramming into the oven, it turns the oven on and the gas starts to build up. So Preacher's like, oh, this is some shit. Like, I'm not going to be, you know, cooked in my own oven. Like, that's just like, that's just too much irony for, you know, for one man. And he ends up like hacking his way through the top of the, you know, the little oven into this other, like the other, you know, compartment, I guess. And it, so that he can actually get out. Well, the whole room is filling up with gas now. And so as he gets out, he ends up taking his lighter, flicks it on, and then just gives that whole, like, you ate my bird, and then boom, flicks it, and all of a sudden just boom, big ass explosion. It's very, very action film, but it's like it works. It's nice actually making it feel that it's not an action star doing it, like where if you had like let's say it's like Dwayne The Rock Johnson, right? It's like, clearly, it's like if it was Dwayne, it would just have this whole like action hero thing. And this having LL like in his just the chef, you know, uniform and just in his, it's just it felt more realistic and felt more of like just an actual man having to deal with a situation. But again, it's like that big explosion and stuff like that really kind of gives that extra blockbuster action movie kind of feel to it. And there's a lot of scenes that had that kind of feel to the movie. Now, once we get into the film, there was a couple things that really stood out for me when it came to the sharks and things like that. So real quick, before we get into the actual sharks, I had a couple of things where I wanted to get into some actual shark facts. So as I told you guys before, I got into a bunch of like documentaries and things like that. And as I'm watching this movie, there was a lot of those facts that kind of I had that moment of like, whoa, wait a second there, guys. Like, that's not right. Or it's like, hey, like, you know, I had to like put on my thinking glasses and be like, wait a second, hold up, fellas. And then go through. So let's go through a couple of these facts here for you. So right now we're going to go through the segment of, you know, Facts with Lunchbox. And that's a working title. We'll work on that later, you know, as we go through. But fact number one about the Mako shark. So one of my favorite facts is that a Mako shark can reach up to 40 miles per hour. The short fin Mako, the way that their body structure is, they have it's like a very torpedo-like body shape. Over time, I guess it was like the bluefin tuna, I believe, is like their kind of like main food source. The bluefin tuna kind of evolved in to make themselves more sleeker and faster to get away from the Makos. And again, over, you know, evolutionary time, the Mako also kind of evolved into these, again, torpedo-like body shapes to make themselves even faster and what have you. And their fins, like I said, they're short fin Makos, and that also helps them along with, you know, just kind of gliding through and their speed and things like that. But their muscle structure is incredible. And so they just get these like real big, like short bursts, and they just, it propels them through the water at an incredible speed. I think like a person can swim, I think it's like, I think they said it was like 2 feet or something like that. And then in comparison, like as a person swims like 2 feet, a Mako shark can go like 60 feet or something like that. It's not, there's no comparison. It's like, they're like the cheetahs of the sea. Like they're that fast. Another fun fact here, the Mako shark has the largest brain of pretty much any shark out there right now. So kind of like dolphins where they're just very smart. The Mako shark is also very, very smart. It can differentiate a little bit better than most predators out there when it comes to their prey. So things like a great white, most sharks are great whites, bulls, or you know, any other like shark that kind of has like any type of like predator tendencies. Most of the time, like if they are, let's say if they end up attacking a human, most of the time it's like because they're test biting. Like it's, they're just, they want to test whatever it is that they're about to, you know, chomp on. And if they don't like it, then they just kind of just bite and then leave. Most of the time, if they, you know, bite down hard or if they are, you know, kind of going at it a little bit more gusto, then yeah, there's going to be some serious injuries, and which there have been. But most of the time, it's not as like, you know, most movies will, you know, put towards these predators. These are just like, oh no, they see like a shadow from, you know, below, and you know, thinking it's a seal or whatever, you know, they're wanting to eat, and then they swim up, bite, and then they go, oh nope, I don't like that, and then you know, piss off. But with Mako sharks, they, I guess, like the studies have shown that they can, like I said, differentiate from a person or fish or whatever they're going to eat. And so they don't really have that tendency of actually attacking, or they're actually not aggressive towards humans at all. There's only, this is another, again, that kind of leads into this next fun fact, is that between 1580 and 2022, there's only been 9 attacks on humans. So, and 3 of those were fatal. And that's where that whole thing kind of goes into it, where it's, you know, Mako's just kind of don't care about humans. I think most, like, shark researchers and things like that, when they do come in contact with Mako's, I think there's a few documentaries that I've seen where they do, like, free diving, where they get out of their cage because they don't, like, the Mako's will be curious, but they're not going to be aggressive. And that's something that's really, really interesting on that end. Another really fun fact is that along with being able to swim about, you know, within, like, those short bursts of, like, 40 miles per hour, a Mako shark can breach out of the water up to 30 feet in the air. Which is insane. That is a huge leap. I mean, that's like, I mean, you just, you know, put a torpedo up and just straight up. Like, that's incredible. And they use that so that they can, you know, go after, you know, their prey and things like that. And I mean, you know, a breaching shark is just one of the coolest things ever. Like, I love that documentary, Air Jaws. Like, that was another, but that was a lot of, it was the great whites coming out of the water. But, you know, like, seeing a Mako shark, I saw a video on YouTube one time, and it was like that thing just, it was like a bullet just coming straight out of the water. Really, really, really incredible. One of our other fun facts here is the Mako shark, the largest one that they've ever caught was about 11 to 13 feet. It was a female, and it was massive. I think it was about 2,000 pounds, but it was the largest Mako shark that was caught, and recorded. So, and for our last fun fact, one of my favorites. So, if you have ever seen the poster of Jaws, that shark that is swimming up to reach that poor lady on that, the iconic poster, that is not a great white shark that they're using. That is indeed a Mako shark. That is that is the face of Jaws. I always love that. Is I watched another documentary on it was one of the documentaries that was on the Blu-ray for Jaws, and they were talking about the with the artist on what he did, and he walked into a museum and saw a model of a Mako shark that was hanging up, and you could walk right underneath it. And as he was doing that, he looked straight up, and he could see that image that we see on the poster is what he looked at. And it's just seeing all those gnarly teeth and just the shape of the head. And it's like, it just looked just ghastly. Like, it just looked like it would not be a lot of fun to have that just, you know, coming after you type of thing. So again, making that just a massive, you know, size, make, you know, putting the woman at the top. It's really, really terrifying. I know that the great white is kind of like the cousin to the Mako, but, again, it's like the great whites are definitely like beefier, maybe not as like sleek looking. So it's just, it's funny. And also too, their teeth are, I guess, more triangular than they have like a little bit more uniform to them. Whereas like a Mako is a little bit more kind of chaotic. Like, it's just the teeth just kind of stick out, and you know, more of a gnarlier fashion. So again, it's, yeah, the shark on the poster for Jaws is actually a Mako shark. So that was my little, again, fun facts with Lunchbox. So the more you know. All right, now back into the sharks of this film. Now, I gave you guys all those little fun facts because a lot of the stuff that was happening in this movie with these sharks just seemed a little bit very, very far-fetched there. For instance, they had two different generations of sharks in this film. They called them like Gen 1, Gen 2. Gen 1 were the sharks that were kind of like your typicals. Like they were just caught. They were the fresh. They were the babies. They were, or I say babies. They were the new to the facility sharks. And they were about 12 feet, right? So that was probably like the largest of the Mako sharks. Then this is where it got, like I had to like kind of hit the fuckery button. But the Gen 2 sharks, that I believe there was two of them, there was two gens, but the larger one, the largest out of them, ended up being 25 feet long. And I think in the film, for some reason, I have to look back at it, but I think at one point they even said it was like 45 feet, and I was like, that just doesn't seem like it's that, whatever. But I'll have to double check my my findings on that. But they, to confirm, like I looked through my other research, like through the internets and whatnot, the largest shark that they had in there was 25 feet long. And that was about the same size as Bruce in Jaws, which again, for a great white shark is insane. So, but like I said, the largest Mako shark that's ever been recorded was only it was like 11 to 13 feet. So they kind of took that and just, they amped that shit up crazy big. And to think to have like a Mako shark, like that's 25 feet long is insane. And then, then they also had that, that little tidbit about how high they could jump, right? So they could shoot out of the water about 30 feet. Well, in the film, right after the first test shark gets out, they Carter goes to Scoggins and he's like, hey, how big are the outside fences from the water? And Scoggins is looking out and you could see the facility and he's like, oh, well, underneath the water is all titanium fencing, so they can't break through it. It's just, it's way too strong for them. But the fence on top is only 8 feet tall. So Carter says, okay, cool. You got to raise them up. So they only raise them up about 10 feet. Well, so they're worried about a shark being able to jump over the fence for 10 feet. Where, lo and behold, if they get enough speed and they get enough leverage, they could jump up, as I said, 30 feet. They could clear those fences and not have a problem with it. And that's the 12-footers. Now let's think about the fucking 25-footer. That thing, there would be no fence. Like it's just, it would just clear that thing like fucking Free Willy. Like it's just, there's nothing holding that fish inside that facility. And that was the thing that killed me about this movie, was that they're worried about a 10-foot fence and the sharks getting out over it. And then, like, at the end of the movie, because I'll get into this too, but the sharks are thinking more. They are now trying to flood the facility so that it sinks the facility so that all the fencing and everything goes down and they can just swim out. And I was like, that's the most insane thought process I think I've ever come across. But and then I was like, at the end of the movie, one of the sharks is actually trying to bust out of one of the fences, or it's the 25-footer. He's trying to bust out of the fence, and it's just, he's having a really hard time. And I'm like, dude, just fucking jump. Just jump over the shit. Just go. But that's about it. Now, one of the other things that I thought was just so, like, why would you even think to do that? Was, so, Susan, her and Dr. Whitlock, they are in charge of this whole process of dealing with these sharks. And what their whole idea was that the shark's brain and the enzymes, like, well, first of all, it's like, one, sharks don't get cancer. They don't get sick. They never really, I mean, when they sleep, they can constantly keep moving their bodies. Like, their brain function is just absolutely, it's incredible. And so what they were wanting to do is to test on these sharks and try to, like, I guess, manipulate the enzymes from their brain and put it into, you know, I guess, use that kind of chemical on a person that, like, that has Alzheimer's and try to eradicate, or, you know, like, to help the brain functions and things like that, so that it could get the brain up to speed as to, you know, to where it needs to be. But however, the even though that the Mako's brain is large already, they needed it bigger. So they went behind Chimera's back. Chimera had this this kind of rule in play that, you know, there could be no genetically modifying or anything like that. And lo and behold, Susan and Whitlock ended up going in and doing some fuckery. So they ended up genetically modifying these sharks to make their brains bigger. And in order to do that, there is, like, because I guess the enzymes that they were getting wasn't enough. And so they needed a bigger brain to get more. And, but in doing so, they, it, I guess, like, I don't, I believe it increased the size of the shark somehow. I don't know how, but I guess it did. But the crazy thing is that it actually made the shark smarter. So, like I said, the Mako is already one of the smartest sharks. It's got the biggest brain, and now you just made it even smarter. And so I thought that was hilarious, where not only was it set, like, as an audience member watching this film going, holy shit, like, this is, like, that sounds absolutely crazy. Even the people in the film were going, like, why the fuck did you do that? Like, you, it's like, you screwed all of us. It's like, you messed with the fish, and now the fish are messing with us. Like, that, like, everyone's so mad at Susan because she went behind everybody's back and did all this stuff because she was so, like, just gung-ho about just making sure that she could just cure Alzheimer's. Like, that, like, even, like, as she was explaining it to everybody, it was just like, anytime it was just like, I was like, oh, but Alzheimer's, but we could cure it, we could do this. But, like, you could see on everybody's face, we were like, we don't give a shit. It's like, I care about my life more than making sure that, you know, we could save that. At that point in there, at what they're dealing with, it's like, they could not care. And that was like a type of thing where, like, it was when they were first doing the little procedure to extract the enzymes from the shark's brain. So they knock it out, or they drug it, and they have it in this, like, little, like, harness. Susan goes in, does her needle thing, and Franklin, he is amazed at the size of the shark. And he goes, he's like, what on God's green earth? And, or he's like, or some line like that. It's like, basically, you know, kind of mentioning, like, oh, like, what has God created? And then, like, Whitlock is standing next to him. He's like, oh, like, God didn't create this. We did. And, like he's proud of the genetic, like, just the things that he's doing, and, like, what Susan did to genetically modify that animal. And it's just one of those things where it's kind of like science did that whole thing of, it's like, we're all about coulda, not shoulda. And it really backfired on them really quickly. Because right after the procedure's done, they turn around and they put the enzyme into the Alzheimer's little test sample, and they're getting the brain firing. Like, everything's working. Like, all the research and everything that they've been doing, like, that is the, you know, end all be all. Like, yes, it works. We know it does. Like, that's fantastic. Like, our, you know, research is going great. And Franklin is, like, super happy. He's just like, awesome. Like, I'm, you know, clearly, like, his money's not being wasted. But then Whitlock ends up, he puts a cigarette in his mouth and he's being all cocky. And he walks right up to the shark and he just puts his, like, he, like, leans down. He starts, like, he's like, oh, like, he just gives some type of, like, comment. And all of a sudden the shark wakes up. And then lunges at him and just bites his arm clean right off. And it's a very, very intense scene because... And it's one of those, like... like, not J.J. Abrams, but, like... it's kind of like a Zack Snyder kind of moment because everything goes in slow motion and everyone... Like, I mean, so it's like you got... you know, Whitlock just, like, he's on the ground bleeding. And then Janice... you know, she's like freaking out trying to save him. And then Carter, he rushes over to the gun cabinet, breaks open the glass. He's going to go and shoot the fish, which is the right answer. But Susan, she freaks out and she's like, no, you can't shoot it. And then she hits the button and releases the fish back into the ocean, or, you know, back into the facility. And everyone's just like freaking out. Well, it escalates from there because as they're trying to get Whitlock, air vac'd, on top of this, there's also a hurricane coming. So, like, just to add more shit onto this pile. But there's a hurricane coming, so there's a big-ass storm. They're trying to get him airlifted. And then out of nowhere, as they're craning him up, the crane jams. And then all of a sudden, it just drops him down into the shark tank. And then all of a sudden, you get the tightening of the line. One of the sharks has got the poor doctor that's hooked up to this fucking... His gurney. And then all of a sudden, as our team is going back down into the lab, they're all trying to figure out what's going on. And then out of nowhere, this big ass explosion happens. It turns out that the shark has dragged the helicopter into the main, like, office area where our, I guess she is the person that kind of watches the weather, and she, helps, like, navigations and things like that. I forget what her actual job is, but it was Brenda. You know, she blows the fuck up. Like, she just, big explosion, just fire, assholes and everything everywhere. And so the team downstairs, like, or, like, down in the research lab, they don't know what's going on. And the only image they get is from a camera of a helicopter going into it, and then it's just boom, big explosion. But then Franklin looks out at into the little tank area, and he's like, hey, there's something. He's like, can anybody tell me what this is? And he sees something coming towards him, and it turns out that it's Whitlock in the mouth of the massive 25 foot Mako, and the Mako's throwing him towards the glass to break it. So he smashes himself into the glass, and all of a sudden it's just this, all the, like, it just starts to spider web, and it just, and that's where everything just, like, just kind of, it just escalates all from there, because, like, the glass breaks, and then just water just floods right in. And then, like I said, from that point, that's when we get this whole thing of like just water just coming in everywhere. There's nowhere safe for them, which is an awesome little thing, because it's like in a place that you're supposed to be safe, there's nowhere for you to go. Like I think at every turn that there's some type of peril, there's some type of danger. That was one thing that with this film I felt was really interesting, was at some point with like these blockbusters, you kind of have this feeling of like, okay, who's going to survive? Who's going to die? Who's going to be the fodder? And like I said, what was interesting was that you never really got that sense of who was going to stay and who was going to go. To kind of give it a comparison, it was kind of like The Walking Dead. In The Walking Dead show, it's like 1 week, you have no idea who's going to get bit. You don't know who is going to survive into the next, few seasons. Like, it's really refreshing, because, some of your favorite characters, you could sit there and go, oh, shit, like, I really don't want them to die. And all of a sudden, now they're getting got. And a lot of times we had characters, I think my favorite, and I really thought that he was going to get it at one point, was Preacher. But my favorite was Scoggins, because I felt like he was at one point, he was that guy that was like, he was getting too amped up, and he was one of those like, you know what? No, fuck you. I ain't doing this. I don't work for you anymore. Like, you can't tell me what to do. And then he's like starting to like freak out. But then Carter kind of brought him back in to like, okay, no, you got to work as a team. We got to get out of here. And, we can't, lose our heads type of thing. And they started to like, he kind of got to that point where I was just like, oh no, he's starting to lose it. And like, he's going to lose it to the point where he fucks up and he, like, he messes up at, into a shark's mouth type of thing. But it turns out where he actually gets to the point, they are, I believe, in one of the tanks, and they're trying to empty out one of the rooms or something like that. And they're like, so they're trying to like open up one of the hatches. And as they open up one of the hatches, you think that it's like, oh, like they've made it, everything's good, and like they kind of have like this like high five, like, all right, man, like we did it. And then he turns around and that fucking 25 footer is right behind him, and it literally just swoops in and just swallows him whole. Like, it's just, it's really, really nerve-wracking. And it's just like, because you're not expecting at like after him having this like, all right, yeah, we did it. And then all of a sudden just, nope, he's gone. Like, that's, and it's really, it really kind of throws you off. Another one was Janice. That was a somebody that I thought was actually going to make it a lot longer than what she ended up doing. But hers was really cool, just because they did that whole thing where she's hanging from a ladder. Like, the ladder falls down, and then she's hanging from it, almost like a monkey bars type of thing. And she ends up falling into the water. Carter's trying to, like, reach out for her. She gets pulled under, but then all of a sudden she gets shot up, and she's in the mouth of one of the Makos. And it is such a cool little like slow-mo scene, like seeing the shark come up and then it just take her down, and then you just see the blood and everything else. And then there was another one that I had a kind of a hard time like registering whether or not I cared, like I was happy or not about the death. So at the end of the movie, the 25 foot, like, so the other two sharks have been slayed. The last shark that is alive is the big 25 footer. And it is now on, the top level and it is trying to bust out of the top gate. So Carter, Susan, and Preacher are the, I believe, the last ones that are around. And so they see the shark trying to break out, and they're like, oh, well, we have to stop it. We have to kill it. We cannot let it, it cannot get out. Like, there's no way, like, if it gets out, like, that's going to be, it's just going to cause chaos. So they're going to rig it with the spear gun with a charge, and they're going to try and hook it up to this battery. They're going to spear the fish, and then all of a sudden, you know, take the line, hit it with the battery, and then boom, there, you know, Bob's your uncle. And which is funny because it's like, I guess like that's like the only way like to actually kill a big shark in a cool fashion is by blowing it up. So they do this whole thing and it turns around where I guess the shark is about to get out and they don't have enough time to get everything set up. And so Susan decides that she's going to buy them some time. And she cuts her hand and then jumps into the water as bait. And the shark is literally is about to bust out of the gate. And then all of a sudden it smells the blood. And then it turns around really slowly and then just starts to swim towards her. And Carter's freaking out. He's trying to tell her to get out of the water. And it's this big, like, epic, like, action-y scene. And then right before the shark goes to, like, bite her, it stops and then looks at her like, huh? Like, okay. Like, he just kind of gives, this little smug little thought, like, kind of like, it's almost like if a dog, like, if you say you want some food and it kind of like looks at you and goes, huh? Well, that's kind of what the shark did, and then it just lunged at her and then just went and bit her straight in half. Like, it's a very satisfying kill, but I was very surprised by it because it's like, I thought it was like she was supposed to be our survivor. She's supposed to be our final girl. She was supposed to be the person that, like, had to deal with that whole situation. Because it was all her doing, so it was just really like a really surprising scene to have her die at that moment, like right at the end of the movie, and then it turned around where it's like it's both Carter and Preacher who are the survivors, and they end up, like I said, you know, blowing up the shark and what have you. I don't know, like, so. To kind of wrap this up, and again, you know, thank you guys for hanging in there with me. But like I said, this movie, it's for me, I have a lot of fun with this one. It's very, very silly. It's very, but at the same time, it's also smart. And that's where I kind of give it that little bit of a pass. I mean, like in 1999, yeah, the CGI wasn't, you know, at its best for certain production companies, but again, the for everything else, all the actiony stuff, I was like, the actual, like, the production of it was fantastic. I absolutely love it. It's like, it's one of those movies where it's like, you know what, I just kind of want to throw something on. Yeah, sure, like, I'll throw in some Deep Blue Sea. Like, it's good. Like, it is what it is. But some of the stuff, like with the sharks, like I mentioned, it's kind of outlandish. It doesn't make really sense. I mean, hell, like, probably the one little thing that the sharks do that absolutely drive me crazy, and it's hilarious because even the people in the film also say the same thing. It's hilarious. It's when the sharks see the gun in Carter's hands and they swim backwards. Sharks don't do that. And they even say that in the film. They're like, there's no way that a shark, like, they're like, a shark recognized a gun. It recognized that he, like, you know, that it saw the threat and it swam backwards. I was like, technically, it's like if a shark ever swam backwards, it would die. Like, it just, it would not be able to survive. It has to swim, keep swimming forward, keep on swimming. And so that stuff like that just drives me crazy. Also, like I said, after going through those documentaries and stuff like that and seeing where a shark can jump out of the water 30 feet in the air, it's like, okay. And then also it's like, so if you put that to a larger shark, you know, you're just going to get more force, more lift. So, I mean, it's like those things are just going to just skyrocket. So stuff like that is huge. But then also, you know, using a shark like a Mako because it has a larger brain for what they're trying to accomplish, like I said, was also like a smart idea. I like that. I can ride with that. However, it's I could never really tell if it was because they enlarged the brain size of the Mako, if that caused it to have like more of a predator or an aggressive predator type nature towards humans and things like that. Like if it manipulated it in that way. They never specify anything like that. But like I said, you know, like with Mako sharks, they're not very aggressive. So it's kind of a weird thing to see, you know, like a Mako shark in a film like this. But again, it's also refreshing to not see a great white shark, because I think in the majority of almost, you know, all shark movies, you know, the great white tends to be the end all be all, because that's just your iconic, you know, movie shark. It surprised me. I actually went back and I looked at the Deep Blue Sea 3 trailer just to kind of see like where, you know, they fell with that. And the poster, it shows almost like it's like a megalodon size shark going after a human, but in the film it's a bull shark and they're not very big at all. Like, it's, I mean, bull sharks are nasty little buggers, but I was like, oh, it's kind of like, that's a little false advertisement, because it's like, I don't see, it's like where you're getting these like giant sharks. So I was like, I think I might pass on that one. But for this one, you know, I was all about it. You know, like the comedy aspects of it mixed with the action, on top of, you know, just having that kind of just the premise of the science trying to cure something and then the science coming back to get them. That kind of story just always, it always works for me, because, it's just, you know, it's just people playing God and then just getting God. But for this one, I'm going to give this one just a solid, it's a 3.5 for me. There's things about it that it just kind of makes me just roll my eyes. But at the same time, I can watch it anytime. And that's the thing, is the rewatchability is there. And that's the key that to put it up and over. As much as the outlandishness as it is, at the same time, like, it's still good enough to keep on going, even after, you know, so many years of me watching it. So I'm all about it. But at the same time, I mean, it's like, I want to hear what you guys have to say. This is my first, you know, first real show out. And I am looking to, you know, kind of keep this thing, you know, progressing along. I want to see, you know, what I can do with it differently. So I would love to hear from you guys. You know, please, 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 if you guys are listening to this show, it's like, find me on Instagram, like at Creepin' It Real. And just drop me a message. Just let me know how I did on my first show. You know, be nice. But it's just like, if you guys have, and I think my next, the way that I'm going to work the format is, I'm going to just go back to the random format. So it's going to be a different movie each week. For a while there, we were doing whole franchises. But I think I'm going to go back to doing is just like a random movie every week. I think that, you know, that'll help, you know, keep it fresh and things like that for me. But yes, if you guys have any suggestions on movies you want me to review, you know, just anything you guys, please just message me, drop me a DM, or just email me at creepinitreal.cm at gmail.com. And again, like, my phone's on me all the time. So I will jibber jab with you all day long. But again, I really, really appreciate it. I can't wait for more. Like, this is going to be so much fun. So, and I hope I get better, as time goes by. So I thank you guys so much for, hanging out with me and, for all these seasons that we've been doing Creeping It Real. This is so much fun and I can't wait for more. So, I'm going to leave you guys with this, and the ultimate words of a great, great man. Farewell and adieu to you fair Spanish ladies. Farewell and adieu, you ladies of Spain. For we received orders to sail back to Boston. And so, nevermore shall we see you again.